Don't laugh, Dave. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Right. Everybody ready? 1, 2, 3. Let's show rules!
Eagles! Showtime!
It's a living tech show, and that's fact. If you don't like the cats, you can skid up your ass. Ain't no funny duddies that'll link it fast. But the show name goes back to DLSGS.org. And I see channels at linuxx.net. Bound Tech Show. Just sit right there, cause the count is just about to begin.
All right. Welcome to the Linux Link Tech Show, episode 374. The first episode of November.
Woo-hoo.
That's right. Woohoo! All you
Christmas
want.
Christmas music is already playing.
Really? Where?
Oh, saw
on
the first,
radio?
Saw the first commercial today.
Oh, just about every store I've gone into.
Huh? It's a little early. I saw that they had the Santa Claus thing up at the mall when I went in for my yearly entrance into the mall.
That's so sad.
Sitting in his lap.
No, it was all blocked off. They didn't. They had it all set up, and you could see like through translucent curtains that's what it was. And it was.
You had your nose pressed up there, didn't you? You were.
Yeah.
You just,
I was Santa. Where are you?
Waiting for Santa.
And you know what would make a good Christmas gift, by the way?
What?
Cooking for Geeks.
Why would you say that, Dan?
Well, I believe that's because the author is on with us tonight.
That's right. Look at you taking it right into the segue.
Hell yeah! How about that?
Oh, yeah. Jeff Porter is our wonderful guest tonight from the fantastic, excellent book, Cooking for Geeks, which I think I'm safe to say at least three of us have and have been reading. Do you have it, Dan?
No, I don't, but I'm actually going to get the... I saw that there's a version of it on the Android Marketplace, so I'm going to put it on there.
Yes, get don't get the Kindle version. Get the
version. Get the actual APK that they have out there. That's the one.
That one works. That one works really good. Now, instead of us just talking about it, let's hear Jeff Porter. How you doing tonight, Jeff?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
It is a... What inspired you to write Cooking for Geeks? Now, I kind of know, but tell
well, you know, I would jokingly say that I was hungry, and I wasn't quite sure why I was doing certain things. But really, the background of the book is actually kind of one of these funny, right place, right time type stories, which can be so incredibly frustrating for anybody that thinks they want to go and do something like it. I had given a talk at one of the O'Reilly Foo conferences, and they came up to me afterwards and essentially said, hey, you should write a book on this stuff. And I was like, sure, how hard can that be? Totally famous last words. I don't remember 2009 at all because basically it went straight into doing the book and half of 2010 as well. But the book for me really is kind of an opportunity to sit down and understand why it is we do certain things in the kitchen from a science point of view. So I have been cooking most of my life. My parents always took time to cook with me growing up. But there were a lot of things I just didn't really understand, like why do we do it this way, or why do you set your oven to that temperature, or how do I know what kinds of flavors go well together, or why do they even go well together? And so for me, the book is really an opportunity to sit down and like dig through the literature and just try to understand like how does this thing work? Like any good hacker or, you know, geek or whatever word you want to use, I have that curiosity about how things work. And like, I love taking them apart and trying to figure out, hey, you know, what's going on here? What's the actual, like, gears turning underneath the hood? And for me, the book was just really a chance to do that for food. And it turned out to have been a lot more fun than I would have ever imagined.
Well, I'll tell you what, it's a lot of fun reading. And you know what I did a week after I started reading the book? I went into my kitchen. What?
I'm afraid you're going to say you clipped the lock off your oven door.
No, not yet. Didn't do that yet. I went in and I removed the doors from my cupboards so that I can that, I found that, you know, thinking about that, I'm like, you know what? That is right. It's such an annoyance to have to keep opening and closing those things. And half the time they're open and you bang your head on them. And if I want to grab something, I did that. I rearranged my entire kitchen so that I can make it more functional for my purposes. And screw everybody else.
Yeah, no, I think we all have this conception that kitchens are supposed to be a certain way because it's how we see, like, kitchens done on TV shows or done in the magazines or food, wherever. But it's like, no, get in there and treat it like, you know, any space that you would treat your own. Like, I mean, if you look at how so many of us, people who use computers and hack on them all day long, how we arrange our workspaces, like, we get in there and we customize it. We do stuff that makes sense so that it's our space. But somehow we forget to do that in the kitchen. So definitely, I encourage, you know, anybody to get in there, just like, hey, you know, should I put this here or there? Or just take a minute to think about it. Like, in my case, like, it took me a while to realize, but it seems silly in hindsight. I keep my garlic press right next to my garlic. Because otherwise, every time I go to use garlic, I have to walk over to the other drawer, find the garlic press, wherever it is in that drawer, pull it out and use it. And now it's like it just sits next to the garlic. And it's like, why would you put it anyplace else? Because you're not going to use it with anything else.
You know, that is so true. That is so true. I mean, having it at your fingertips where it's with the items that it goes with is a huge convenience.
Yeah, totally. And, like, I mean, there's tons of trips like that. Like, besides just the garlic and the garlic press thing, you know, measuring cups, like keeping the dry measuring cups next to your flour and whatever else it is you know, normally measure out. Or keeping your scale next to, you know, again, your bowls that you are normally using it with. Like, it just turns out if you can figure out how to do this, you're essentially like, you know, you're like pre-linking your recipe and your instruction set of how you're executing through it, you know, whatever it is you're baking. It's like, if you can just optimize those things away, it goes that much faster. So, yeah, I totally, that's actually really cool to hear that you went in and took all the doors off of your kitchen. Did you get any flack from any family members?
Not at all. You know, I do most of the cooking, so they were fine with it, and no glasses have fallen out of the cupboards. It's made it easier. The doors aren't open. In fact, my wife said, you know, hey, that works for her. It's even better.
Congrats. That's great.
Yeah. You don't have, like, pot lids or something that sometimes don't fit right. You know, pushing the door open, and then when you close it and you bump it and you open it again, they all come cascading out. You don't have that problem because stuff can hang over a little bit.
Right.
And you can also see when it starts to get gnarly and you got to clean it, so.
There is that, too. It keeps you honest.
Yes, it does.
It does. Now my question for you.
I don't see that happening in my house, though, Dan.
Me either.
What, it getting dirty? Gnarly?
No.
Or
taking the doors off or whatever.
Yeah, it's not necessarily for everybody, but if it's something that would work for you, at least think about it and go and try it.
I'm telling you, man, free yourself from the doors and windows.
I at least made sure that I organized everything so that it's at least convenient for me. I know I may have to open up the doors a bit more, and I actually, you know, I have this little magnetic key because I got two kids that are, you know, 4 and 2, and I don't want them going in certain, you know, drawers and stuff like that and doors in the kitchen. So I'm constantly with that thing on me as well, you know, but, you know, otherwise everything else is pretty much organized so that I can get quick access to it and stuff like that, so.
You got it, Dave, Dan.
Now, Jeff, one of the problems that I've always had in my kitchens have unfortunately been very small and not easy to, you know, have a lot of counter space, which I find is a premium. I mean, how have the kitchens been that, like, which kitchen, like, the size of it?
My kitchen is pretty generous. I'm quite lucky to actually have a kitchen that's got some real space. But when I was doing the background research for the book and looking at kitchen layouts, there's a book called, it's a pattern language, I think. And, like, it's an identical book in the computer science world. It's a different one. This one's by Alexander Pope et al. And it basically, he looks at a bunch of different rules of thumb that come up in architecture over and over and over, and one of them has to do with counter space in kitchens. And what his research showed was that you need essentially 3 distinct sections of countertop where each of them is at least 4 feet long. And it may seem kind of generous at first and, you know, perhaps decadent to have so much counter space, but it turns out that you kind of need a space for your dirty dishes, a space for your ingredients you're working with, and a space for the stuff you've just cooked that's essentially, you know, cooked meat, don't want to get any contamination. And this three-section rule turns out to be really handy. So if you've got a really tight kitchen, what I would encourage you to do is figure out if there's a way that you can somehow create more counter space top. Now, it might be something as simple as, hey, I can just throw this cutting board over the sink, and, or maybe if you happen to have two sinks or something. You know, if there's a way of extending countertop to a region that would normally have something else on it. I had a college apartment that I was renting that had kind of a galley kitchen style, that at one end of the little galley hallway was a door going to the outside world. And it took me a couple of months until it dawned on me that I could actually throw a cutting board across the actual hallway. So I put a 2x4 up against the wall and put two little dowel pins in there so that I had something to kind of key into. And then I just got a couple of maple boards from like Home Depot and slapped them together, something that I knew would be fine for food, and just kind of created my own like little temporary like counter cutting board top that I could just drop into place across that little hallway. And it was fantastic because that kitchen had, I think, one counter that was 2 feet. It was impossible. It was never meant to actually be a studio apartment. It was like they had taken some carriage house in Providence and divided it into four. So it was like, yeah, here's your kitchen. I'm like, okay, it's better than a dorm room, but it was nothing. And I still have that cutting board to this day. Actually, I'm looking at it because I'm up here in Cambridge next to my kitchen. I can see it. But, you know, even clever little tricks like that can go a long way towards helping you really get just enough space to be able to swap things in and out. Because if you don't have enough space, if you're completely out of space, you run into exactly the same thing that happens in your computer when you run out of memory. Like, you just have no place to put that pot down or that dish down. Like, suddenly it's just like you lock up because you have to, like, figure out what to do and, like, wash some dishes and get rid of some other stuff and, like, page things in and out of your cupboards or whatever it is. And, like, it ends up being impossible otherwise. So getting enough counter space actually is really worth the work that it might take you to figure out how to do. Clear off appliances that you're not using very often. Figure out if you can throw something over a sink and maybe even rig up a temporary cutting board that you can swing down or put into place as the occasion needs.
What we did is we have an island in our kitchen, and it just wasn't quite large enough, so we ended up buying an actual separate butcher block that has shelving underneath it so we could just stack some appliances like my wife's KitchenAid and a bunch of other things that are like that. They're out there, they're easily accessible, yet this gives you a whole extra, you know, 2.5-3 feet of space on top of the whatever size the butcher or the island happened to be.
That sounds
really,
fantastic.
Really well for that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, and if you're looking for good Christmas gift ideas, and you know your kitchen doesn't have enough space and your significant other cooks, you know, there's like a really cool thing you can do for somebody where it's like, hey, I made you this, you know, this really cool cutting board that fits into this particular space here, you know, to help you, your cooking go better.
That's some good ideas. You got me thinking now how I can hack my kitchen space and get more counter.
Yeah, you can really almost, I don't think I've ever seen too much counter. I mean, your main appliances that are too far away from each other can be annoying, but having extra space is, really, who's going to complain?
Yeah, the three counter rule that you talked about, or rule of thumb, is you see that in a lot of labs. The labs I've worked in had three counters, you know, for people to work at, and that works out really good.
Yeah, there's just something about it. And, like, I'd almost rather have three counters each 4 feet long than one 12-foot counter. And I don't really understand it psychologically, though. It just seems better.
Well, yeah, it's a lot of walking back and forth along that 12 feet when you can fit into between the four different counters.
So you talk about organizing the kitchen area. What utensils or tools do you absolutely find invaluable and are a must in your kitchen?
For me, really it boils down to a good knife, a cutting board, a spatula, a wood spoon, a frying pan. And I think at that point you probably have a kitchen set up that's better than 95% of the world. You can get fancier, and you can say, well, really, I want this and that. And yeah, you know, right up in there in that short list would be things like a good thermometer, a good instant read thermometer, just so when you're working with foods, you can make sure you've actually hit the right temperature. And you can get into more exotic stuff. You know, I would probably say the next tool I'd get past that set of things would actually be a sous vide rig, which is like so exotic for most people, but for me is so basic. You know, I'd rather have a sous vide rig than a microwave. It's one of these things where once you start learning what it can do and how to use it, it just turns out to be fantastic because it's essentially letting you cook very precisely. But really, I don't think that one needs to get too bogged down in utensils. Now, if you're the sort of person who really likes to geek out over a really good knife, or you really want to get into certain kinds of appliances or coffee makers or whatever, power to you. Like, there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. But I don't think it's necessary. The analogy I like to give here is actually that of Yo-Yo Ma playing the cello. I think so many people, when it comes to cooking, get really worked up about, is their equipment good enough? Is it the best thing? You know, what do the Consumer Report type places say about what's the perfect blender to get? And it's like, I look at it and think, well, if it blends, you know, great, it blends. Like, yes, it can be a joy to use a really good blender. You know, it's not like bad tools should be tolerated. But an okay, acceptable tool is perfectly fine. And I don't think one needs to get too obsessed about making sure it's perfect. The reason I say Yo-Yo Ma on the cello is if you look at Yo-Yo Ma, a third grader, a Stradivarius, and a cheap cello, giving a third grader a Stradivarius is not going to make the third grader a better cello player. But giving Yo-Yo Ma that really cheap, crappy cello, like, he's still going to be almost as good. Which is to say, it really comes down to the performer, not the tools. And the same thing is definitely true in the kitchen. If you go into the kitchen and you have some confidence about what it is you're working with, and you're not really, like, you know, afraid to get in there and try stuff, it's going to come out okay, whether you've got that, you know, cheap third-grade cello or Stradivarius. Now, if you're a professional and you really know what you're doing, sure, the Stradivarius is going to be better, you know, hands down. But, like, only by a few percentage points, not by the levels that one kind of normally thinks of. So kitchen setups to me are one of these things where, yeah, you want enough counter space, you want a comfortable working environment, but it doesn't have to be anything that's, like, an amazing, optimal, perfect layout. It just needs to be enough that it's a good working space for you.
What exactly is a sous vide rig? Well, how's that actually pronounced, sous vide rig?
Yeah, sous vide. Rig is not actually part of it, the actual term. So sous vide is it's S-O-U-S-V-I-D-E. And if you hit my website, cookingforgeeks.com, and click on the blog, one of the more recent blog posts is actually how to make your own sous vide rig. Sous vide is basically a way of cooking food, kind of ultra-low temperature poaching. I have to back up and give you a little bit of food science for this to make sense. So, you ready?
Do it.
Okay, so if you take something like steak or eggs or chicken or turkey breast or whatever, these things are all made up of a bunch of different things. Like, they're not just like a block of tofu where it's like one thing, essentially. And in the case of things like meats especially, there's a lot of different proteins. And those different proteins that make up the meat, because there's more than one kind of protein, they happen to cook and denature at different temperature points. And depending upon the protein, it turns out that we like some of them cooked and denatured, and we like other ones of them native, uncooked. So something like steak has two primary proteins. One's called myosin and one's called actin. And these two proteins really constitute the majority of the muscle, at least enough for our purposes here. And it turns out that myosin begins to cook around 122. And I say begins to cook because these are rate of reactions. These are chemical reactions. You get hotter, the rate of reaction picks up. But around 122 or so, it begins to go. And this other protein, actin, begins to go around 150. So it turns out if you look at things like medium rare steak, which is texturally preferred by most people, if you actually do like a taste test panel and cook steaks to a whole bunch of different levels of doneness, most people will prefer it done to medium rare. This medium rare doneness is basically at a point where a fair amount of the myosin protein has been cooked and denatured, whereas most of the actin protein, well, almost all of it, is still native and unchanged. So this happens around like 135 to 140 degrees. And it turns out, if you just take a piece of steak and drop it into an environment that's 135 to 140 degrees, what'll happen is eventually that steak will get to that temperature, the myosin proteins will denature, and the actin will remain native. And you get a perfectly cooked piece of medium rare steak. You can't overcook it, and it's delicious. So sous vide itself is actually a French term. It's French for under vacuum. The term first came around in the 1970s when a guy over in France kind of hypothesized all this, and sure enough, it turns out to work great. You put your meats into a vacuum bag, you know, that's home food sealer, food saver type things, and that's just so that when you're working with the food in the sous vide rig, that you're not actually, like, washing away any flavors. So I should actually back up and say what sous vide actually is in terms of equipment is it's essentially a fancy water aquarium heater pump. You basically get a bath of liquid, just like, think of a pot of liquid, where you set the temperature to that pot to be 140 degrees. Now, because you can't do this on top of your burner, you can't just, walk over to your stove and put the pot down and set to 140, you have to use a piece of specialized equipment that actually looks at the temperature and cycles the heat on and off to precisely control it at 140. And this is exactly what sous vide means, is, to cook in a water bath where you put the food into a bag to seal it so that the water doesn't actually chemically interact with the food, but you still get a fair amount of, all the thermal energy still gets imparted into that food. You drop it into the water bath, and then, you hold it for a long enough period of time that the proteins in the meat cook appropriately, and you also kill any bacteria that might have been present in the meat to begin with, effectively pasteurizing it. And it's one of these things that just turns out to be kind of magical, because you really can't overcook things, you can't burn the dinner, and it comes out essentially perfect. I highly recommend doing it. The commercial pros in restaurants, so like all the top restaurants in this country actually do sous vide stuff. It's very common in the high-end culinary scene. They use something called an immersion recirculator, which is a piece of chemistry lab gear that unfortunately costs about $1,000. But if you want to make your own, you can actually just take any sort of thermocouple and thermostatic controller and use a slow cooker, because a slow cooker is designed to hold a body of liquid at a temperature. It's got a heating element. And you use the thermostatic controller and the thermocouple to essentially override the sous vide rig. And you can make your own sous vide rig for about $80 or so.
Yeah, I was looking at that on your website.
Cool.
Yeah, it does. Now, when you cook, like, say you cook, like, a sirloin in there, would you just put it in as is, or would you put like some kind of rub or marinade with it?
You can put a marinade in the bag. In fact, it's actually what I normally do is when I take whatever meat it is I'm working with, I'll drop it into one of these vacuum bags, throw, in my case, maybe it's only olive oil, salt, and pepper, but maybe it's some spices or a marinade or whatever. You drop that in the bag too, and it's a great way to get some flavor in there.
Huh.
I highly recommend it. I mean, like, definitely give it a try.
For under $100, you can make one of these things, and that's not too bad.
No, it's delicious too. I mean, it's totally worth playing with.
Now, I do have one question. Sorry.
Go ahead, Joel. No, go ahead. Go ahead.
Yeah, I do have one question about sous vide. I've often heard many concerns about the fact that cooking at such a low temperature isn't as safe as, say, doing broiling or grilling, whatever. So are you kind of limited in what you would cook there? Like, you wouldn't want to cook pork with sous vide, or?
It's actually not really an issue. The issue or the concern comes around understanding proper hold time. So the Food Safety Inspectional Services, these are the fine folks under the USDA who are responsible for keeping us safe, they actually publish time at temperature charts. So they say you can actually cook your chicken to the low, low, low temperature of 136 degrees Fahrenheit, which is very different than the 165 degrees Fahrenheit that you normally hear bantered around in the consumer literature, i.e. make sure your chicken breast is 165 or you're going to die from salmonella. Now, the reason that they allow 136 is because they also require that you hold it for a sufficient length of time to properly pasteurize it. Critters like salmonella don't live at 136 degrees. In fact, the highest temperature in the food literature for a foodborne pathogen is 131 degrees, which is for Bacillus cereus. The next highest temperature is 122, just to give you an idea how much of an outlier Bacillus cereus is. So essentially, if you hold the food for long enough above 131 degrees, you're going to kill it. Now, that's the issue there, is that you have to hold it for a certain amount of time. And that's why the consumer guidelines say 165. Because at 165 degrees, even if you misprobe the meat by 5 degrees, and even if your thermometer is off by 5 degrees, you essentially kill any parasites instantly. Actually, it's 15 seconds. But they're assuming that if you see your thermometer, say, 165, and it's actually off by 10 degrees, so call 155 degrees, within 15 seconds, anything that's there is essentially going to be dead. But if you drop it at lower temperatures, you have to hold it longer. So the analogy that I like to give is actually that of being in a desert. If you imagine being dropped into a desert environment that's 120 degrees, like, you're going to die. You're going to die at some point. It's not going to be instantly. You might be fine for an hour, maybe two, depends upon, you know, how much water you happen to have, whatever. But if you get dropped into an environment that's 140 degrees, clearly the story is different. You're not going to survive anywhere near as long. And exactly the same thing is true for the pathogens that are potentially present in the food that you're cooking. So the time and temperature bit is really, really important with sous vide. You can't just see, oh, the thermometer says it's 138 degrees, I'm going to pull it out. No, you've got to actually hold it at that temperature long enough to see a sufficient reduction in any pathogens that might be present. And the FSIS folks have done the calculations. They know what the worst-case scenario is and the log D reduction curve for length of time that something needs to be held at that temperature for. So for this reason, sous vide often kind of runs afoul with some of the very simple, shall we say, food safety rules. But the reality is that the very simple food safety rules, things like the danger zone rule, only hold food between 40 and 140 for 4 hours or less, those sorts of things are simplified versions, just as the 165-degree temperature point for chicken breast is a simplified version of a more complicated model. And if you understand the more complicated model, you're certainly safe with it. There's not an issue. And in fact, if you want to think about things like eggs, eggs cook wonderfully sous vide. If you cook eggs at around 148 degrees Fahrenheit, you will get a perfect soft-poached egg. I mean, it's delicious. And you think, well, this might not kill the salmonella. But actually, it will have, because the way that they pasteurize eggs is they hold them in a water bath for a certain length of time. In fact, they hold them in the water bath below 144 degrees, the temperature at which the egg whites begin to denature, but above that 131 temperature point. Essentially, they're making sure that the bacteria is dead, but the proteins aren't denatured. So if you hold it for the appropriate amount of time, you've actually pasteurized it. It's almost guaranteed to be safe. In fact, it's perhaps safer. So if you take something like hamburgers, like take a hamburger. How do you like your hamburger cooked?
Medium rare. Usually. Yeah.
Rare? Medium rare?
Medium rare. Okay.
Yeah, medium rare. If I'm controlling the meat.
Yeah. If you're controlling the meat, what do you mean by that? I have a secret fantasy of going to a food safety convention someday and asking a whole bunch of the food scientists that are at these places, how do you like your hamburgers cooked? Because the thing about medium rare is essentially it's 135 to 140 degrees. Now, if you take a steak, a traditional steak, and you drop it into a grill or a hot pan and you sear it, what happens is the outside gets well above 310 degrees Fahrenheit. And you know this because you actually see this brown Maillard reaction, which is basically one of the browning reactions that creates hundreds of compounds that happen to smell delicious and some of which are also brown. And that reaction doesn't begin to occur until around 310 degrees under normal conditions. You can tell that the outside of the meat got really hot. It basically got sterilized. And things like a steak are what are classified as whole muscle intact meat. They're essentially, well, the inside has been exposed to the outside, and the inside is sterile. So you're not actually concerned about things like salmonella or Bacillus cereus or any of these other critters really being in the middle of that piece of meat. You're only concerned about on the outside. So the outside gets sterilized well above 310 degrees, you're good to go, the middle is uncontaminated. But the issue with hamburgers is that they are all outside, by definition. They are ground-up meat. There is no inside to a hamburger. So you have potential contamination in the middle of your hamburger. So if you cook your hamburger to 140 degrees and you don't hold it there for a sufficient length of time for pasteurization, you can give yourself really nasty foodborne illness. This is why you're told cook your hamburgers to the middle being, you know, 155 degrees. Why not? Why 155 as opposed to 165? That has to do with the composition of the tissue, the amount of fat, potential worst case reduction. Just in terms of, like, there are differences between the tissues, between the different animals, and what the infection can be like. But essentially, you're supposed to cook your hamburgers to 155, maybe even if you want, in some guidelines, 160, using an instant read thermometer to make sure it gets there, which is well above medium rare. It's well above the point at which the actin protein cooks. So you get something which is tough and dry, and most people don't find it particularly delicious. But if you were able to hold it at 140 degrees for a sufficient length of time to properly pasteurize it, you would actually get a hamburger which is both medium rare and food safe. So there are some times when actually using sous vide stuff allows you to do things that you just can't do in a traditional way. And this is one of them. So it's actually really fascinating to think about what you can do using this cooking technique. You have to know what you're doing, but once you know what you're doing, it's actually wide open in terms of the possibilities.
Have you ever done any high-temperature, low-time pasteurization techniques with this device?
You mean like set it up to like 170 degrees, 180 degrees?
Yeah, or higher. I know milk is sometimes pasteurized at high temperatures and low time.
Oh, sure. Yeah, ultra-pasteurization and flash pasteurizing. Yeah, you could definitely do that. The thing with milk, and I don't actually offhand happen to know the temperatures at which the different proteins in milk denature, but there is this cooked milk taste, which comes about from heating it up and some of those proteins denaturing, and that's a non-reversible transformation in the cases of milk proteins that they change their flavor. I haven't tried it directly. I guess if you had raw milk on hand and you wanted to do that, you certainly could. Although milk seems like one of these things where, most people don't happen to have raw milk in hand and need to pasteurize it themselves. And those that do have raw milk in hand generally don't want it pasteurized. They want their milk raw, which, you know, there are pluses and minuses on there. The issue with raw milk, of course, is listeria in pregnant women, which is just, you know, one of these things where really grocery stores should not be allowed to sell raw milk because somebody somewhere is not going to understand and they're going to have a miscarriage because of it.
Cool.
I'm trying to find a good reference there. What did you say it was to look at a good reference for cooking at low temperature and how long you should actually cook something at that temperature?
There's actually a really good reference online by a guy named Douglas Baldwin. He's at the University of Colorado. If you Google sous vide guide, S-O-U-S space V-I-D-E, the first hit should be Douglas Baldwin's A Practical Guide to Sous Vide. And he's done all the calculations for looking at time at temperature for thickness of meat starting at fridge temperature. So if you take something like a 1-inch thick piece of chicken breast from your fridge and put it into a 140-degree environment, how long do you actually need to hold it to make sure that the center gets the temperature and then properly pasteurize it? And he's seemed to back the math out, and other people have checked it and seem to be happy with it in terms of like anecdotal evidence that yes, his calculations are correct. I certainly am fine with them as well. That's a great place to start. There is half a chapter on the sous vide stuff in the book Cooking for Geeks as well. His write-up is very thorough and very detailed, but doesn't really get into the higher level stuff that one might want to know as well, like the food safety stuff. He gets into actually a little bit, but it's definitely worth checking out. And, it's fantastic. It's really one of the best free guides out there on the Internet, and I highly suggest starting there if you're just listening to this.
That's pretty awesome. That is pretty awesome.
What does the meat turn out like in this type of device? I mean, I know how I like a steak, and I know that I'm, more than likely going to grill it. Do something slightly different sometime where I start it in a pan and then finish it in the oven. I know I'm going to have that kind of crust on it, that's going to, happen with the Maillard reaction and whatnot. But when I look at something poached, you're never going to see that. So I don't.
Right.
How does the meat actually turn out inside this?
Well, if you think about that steak that you cook traditionally, where the middle of it's medium rare, and as you go out, you get this kind of gradient of doneness as you go up to the edge, the same, that doesn't exist in a sous vide piece of meat. What will happen is the gradient of doneness will be non-existent. The whole thing, center to edge, will be medium rare, and you get that very nice texture.
Okay.
But you're right. The outside doesn't have any of those browning reactions because, well, by definition, it didn't get to temperature. So what one does is after cooking it sous vide, you drop it in a really hot, like, cast iron pan or on a grill just for, like, 15 seconds or so. Basically, what you're looking for is an external temperature of 310 and an internal temperature of 140. And you can do this because you've essentially made the two variables of internal and external temperature independent of each other. So you basically cook the middle until it's done. And then as a separate stage, you cook the outside until it's done. Whereas traditional cooking methods, you're basically racing both variables at the same time up in temperature. And hopefully, you know, you get the outside done at the same time the middle is done. But so often what seems to happen is the outside gets overdone before the middle is done.
I actually just did this. I was telling these guys last week after the show, I did it with a prime rib. You know, not inside a device like this, but I cooked it low, about 200 degrees till it reached 118 degrees internal, let it carry over till it hit about 130, 132, something like that, then stuck it in a 500 degree oven to give it that crust on the outside.
Yeah,
and when it came out, it was absolutely perfect. You know, the whole thing, medium rare from, you know, inside out, and it was just, it was great.
I believe it. And the only reason that sous vide does it in a water bath as opposed to an oven is that if you set your oven to 140 degrees, by the time the meat actually got to 140 degrees, you would have had some serious food safety issues because air is not a very good conductor of heat. Water just conducts heat about 23 times faster. So what takes 45 minutes in a water bath is going to take 20 hours in your oven. And 45 minutes is well below any sort of threshold for danger zone food safety rules. Whereas 20 plus hours is, you know, screamingly bad.
I guess one of the other things that one can say with cooking that's been on my mind a lot is buying local foods in season. Do you practice that a lot?
I try to. I think that this can get to be a very complicated discussion very quickly. I happen to live in the Boston area where local in season for 6 months out of the year would essentially mean winter over carrots and maybe some squashes that happen to stick around and maybe onions, root cellar type stuff. So it's very difficult here to actually have a modern healthy diet that does not rely on at least some amount of trucked in or shipped in produce from other parts of the world. You know, things like fruit and banana and apple, you know, these things are just, you either have to store them, in the case of apples, which still makes them local, but at least in my case it does. It really depends on where you live. I do think that it's a great way to understand your food better, and I think that you get better quality ingredients generally when you're buying local and in season, just because of the sheer fact that you don't have to deal with you know, making sure that whatever stock you're breeding is suitable for long-distance transport, because that really is an issue for so much of the mass-produced food, is that they have to deal with, well, we have to ship these tomatoes across the country from California. It's 7 days in a truck. And, you know, if you think about a pile of tomatoes sitting for 7 days, many varieties aren't going to handle that. Heirloom tomatoes certainly wouldn't. And, of course, you also run into the issues of just the realistic constraint on our food supply and the global demand for food and what does our future look like in terms of looking at how we're consuming food. And, of course, the other facet that's also in the same topic is supporting your local farmers, which I think is a great thing to do. But it turns into a very complicated discussion very quickly. So it really depends upon what aspect of that you're interested in talking about. I don't know if that helps, but there's a lot of different little threads one can pick up there.
Well, when it's available to you, like you said about your winters being, you know, what, a bit longer than probably most in the country, you know, it's good to support, you know, that local economy and your local community, and us being of Linux mind here, we all are about supporting the community, correct?
Absolutely. You know, the thing about local stuff is your grocery stores are probably sourcing local stuff anyway, if they can, because for them it's cheaper.
Actually, I was going to say, my local Kroger here, big old sign in the summer, Ohio-grown local foods, right in front of the store, foods that were grown less than 100 miles away from here.
Yeah, so, and the reason they do that is that a lot of food's grown in California, but food's grown all over the country. And if you start looking at the cost of shipping it versus buying locally, it's cheaper for the grocery store to buy local. So I think a lot of the chains have started to figure out that we can slap up a local sign, you know, a third to half the time out of the year and make people feel better about the produce they're buying. Which leaves you with the other half of the year. What do? Well, you know, if you look at 50, 70 years ago, when shipping produce across the country just wasn't really done, what people did was they pickled stuff and preserved stuff and made jams or, you know, dried things. And this is all good, but you ended up with higher incidences of things like stomach cancer from all the amount of vinegar and acid that people were consuming back then. So it's like a supply of fresh produce year-round that's not necessarily local turned out to be a great thing from a health benefit point of view. So it's one of these things where it's like you can't really just pull on any individual knob. The entire ecosystem is very connected. As you try making one little tiny change, and mandating it across the board, we will only eat local food, it turns out to be very difficult. There will be unintended consequences in some place, i.e. your stomach cancer rates. But no, whenever possible, absolutely. I mean, it's one of these things where, why wouldn't you? If it tastes better and it's cheaper and it's better for the environment and better for you, I mean, everybody wins, so go for it.
Now, your book has been out there for a good while now.
Just about 3 months, yeah.
Just 3 months. What's the reaction been like from?
Oh wow!
Both the geek community and the I will say the food loving critic, whatever community.
The reaction's really been very overwhelming. It's not something I predicted or expected. It's hard to actually articulate a good answer to this. It's gotten much more attention than I expected. The book is now into its fourth print run, and that's only in 3 months, I think. So it's one of these things where it's just people really have been digging it, which has been, you know, really quite nice. I mean, I wrote it essentially for myself. Like, this is a book I wish I had 10 years ago to answer the questions that I didn't understand. And I didn't really have any concept of how it might do when it came out. You know, it's like, yeah, I hope it sells some copies, right. But I didn't think it would be into fourth print run territory within 3 months of being out. I didn't think it would end up in, like, USA Today or on the Today Show or NPR or the list goes on. I mean, it's like, it's incredible how much people really seem to be liking the book. And I think one of the biggest hurdles for me, actually, is getting people who are not traditional geeks to understand that what a geek is can really be much more than a computer geek. And what I invariably find is somebody will pick up the book and they'll say, oh, I'm going to buy this for my son or daughter for Christmas. And they start flipping through it, and they come back 5 minutes later and say, I'm going to need a second copy for myself. And that's just been a fantastic thing to see happen over and over. But it also is something that's really frustrating for me, because there's all these people who actually would really like the book if they would just crack the cover open and go and look at it. And as the title kind of suggests, you know, Cooking for Geeks, it means that these people don't think it's for them. Coming up with a good title is incredibly difficult, and Cooking for Geeks is at least memorable. So no complaints on the title, but it is something that really, you know, Cooking for Food Scientists or Cooking with Science just doesn't have quite the same ring to it as Cooking for Geeks. So I'm right. Happy with the title, but it's definitely been one of the uphill battles to get people to realize, wait, this is more than just for your, you know, traditional geek.
Right. I was going to say, you know, I've taken so many hints from the book and used them. I know probably Dan probably already said some of the same things, but, like, one of my favorites was just putting the pizza stone in my oven.
Yeah.
Everything is coming out better. It just works so much better.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, And it's little things like, little hacks like that, you know. Even hacks with the food, like the Twitter hack, or the Maureen Evans,
Twitter
cookbook. I love that. I mean, I actually just made sent a tweet on a shepherd's pie, a recipe for shepherd's pie. I made it. Family loved it. I'm making it again this week.
Nice.
So, I mean, it's little hacks like that. A lot of people just don't think of even how you can take technology, like computers and stuff, and apply it to cooking.
Yep.
You know, and the mentality behind it, too. And that's what I really like about the book.
Well, thank you.
So.
This is one book, you know, I regret buying. I don't want to say regret buying on the through the Amazon Kindle store on my Android phone, because it is definitely probably one of the few books that I will buy this year in dead tree format too, because I think just having that to be able, like you say, in the book to write in and keep notes in and stuff like that, it makes it a far more valuable asset having it paper, dead tree format, as opposed to an electronic format. But it's also handy to have to take with you wherever you go. It's a tough call.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that. And the Kindle version is, let's just say, translating from a technical point of view, this kind of book from paper version to Kindle is a very difficult proposition. Because the book has actually got a particular layout that just is really difficult to do in Kindle format.
It is. It's such a darn good book.
Thanks.
We do have a question in the IRC.
Okay.
A guy from Scotland. His name is Neil. He just bought the book off of Amazon. He's all excited about the liquid nitrogen ice cream. He wants to know, how do you get your hands on liquid nitrogen?
Well, Neil, thank you for the question, and thank you for listening all the way from, the power of the Internet. Somewhere in the deep, deep, dark jungle of Africa, somebody's probably listening to. I don't have a really good answer for you, unfortunately. I can tell you where I get mine. Welding supply stores tend to carry it, as do some plumbing supply stores. The reason that these guys carry it is if you have a broken pipe that does not have a shutoff valve and you need to cut or work on it, you can freeze the pipe. So you basically could pour the liquid nitrogen over the pipe, creating an ice plug inside the pipe that would then allow you to cut after wherever you froze the pipe to fix the issue. So they do have it, and you can look in your white pages listing to see you know, where your closest one is. The bigger issue really is getting a container to transport it in, and also understanding what the regulations involved in transport are. So here in the United States, it is classified as a hazardous substance. You do need to be aware of the transportation requirements. There are two types of containers. One is they're called DEWAR, DEWAR. One is pressurized, one is non-pressurized. Now, a pressurized DEWAR is essentially a pressure bomb with an escape release valve on it to let any excess pressure bleed off. And the advantage of them is that they can hold the liquid nitrogen for a very long time, you know, half a year level. But they require placarding and licensing to actually transport, and they're not things that I have worked with. The non-pressurized ones, you can essentially throw in your car if you're careful and drive around with. But you have to understand, again, the regulations. So in this case here, you need to make sure that you're only transporting a small quantity. I think the state of New York classifies a small quantity as, I think, less than 40 liters. And it is your responsibility to actually know the regulations. If you get pulled over by an officer and, like, they want to quiz you on it, you have to know it. In my case, I have a non-pressurized 20-liter DEWAR that I put into the back seat well of my car, and I drive over to the local welding supply company, and they fill it up for me, and I drive back. Now, I'm careful. I roll my windows down to make sure if there's any, you know, whatever, that there's sufficient oxygen present. Because really the danger there is if something happens to the container and it fails, you would essentially suffocate because it's not oxygen. And that's the issue with a small quantity. With a larger quantity, you could actually get bodily harm if you actually got splashed with it and, you know, whatever. So really the big challenge is finding a appropriate container that you can transport it in. You can look on eBay for Dewars. A 2 to 4 liter Dewar would probably be about what you're looking for, and I would expect to pay at least a couple $100 for it. They're unfortunately quite expensive. But that's the detailed long answer. And I wish you luck in doing it. And if you find out information for different countries or if anybody who's listening has any really great tricks on how to handle this, I would love to hear from you. My email is easy to find if you just go to cookingforgeeks.com. Send me an email. Let me know what you found that works for you. But that's kind of the full story as far as I see it.
Ice cream that was made with liquid nitrogen, I had to say, it's awesome.
Yes. Yes, it is. It's awesome, so because awesome. The ice crystal structure is so small because it freezes so quickly, they don't have chances to form larger aggregates. So you can be much sloppier with the recipe. You don't need to carefully balance fat, sugar, and moisture to get like an appropriate cream. You can just basically throw milk into a bowl and whisk it. The other thing is you can throw alcohol in there. Since ethanol does not normally freeze under traditional ice cream methods, but it does with liquid nitrogen, you can actually make some fantastic alcoholic ice creams that you just can't make any other way.
So, pretty expensive just to make some ice cream, though, isn't it? How much does liquid nitrogen run you?
Liquid nitrogen itself is actually relatively cheap. It cost me, I think, $40 for 20 liters. And the guys at my local fill station, they charge $40 minimum because it just takes... they say they actually lose more liquid nitrogen getting the transfer hose cold, getting the system up to actually throw the liquid nitrogen into the container. So it ends up being, you know, maybe $2 in liquid nitrogen to make a quart of ice cream.
And how long does liquid nitrogen last?
It depends on how well insulated the container you're working with. Uh-huh. In my case, the container I have is extremely well insulated. It actually holds for about 3 months. I was very surprised to learn this. I actually held some once when I was not working with it for a while to kind of find out. And after 3 months, there was still enough to make a decent batch of ice cream. But generally, the smaller containers, the kind of the 2 to 4 liter things, you're going to expect a day or two. You could basically go down the day before you want to do it, fill it up, bring it home, leave it someplace where it's going to be safe and out of the way, and then, you know, you're good to go. But it doesn't last particularly a long time. I mean, it really just depends on how well insulated the container is.
And I would guess on top of that, if you're interested in doing this, you should probably look up some safety tips online, too.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Please do not just listen to me and go and get some. It's not dangerous to work with if you understand the issues, but the issues are very real. You can kill yourself in all oxygen. It will suffocate you. It will freeze you. It will hurt you. You know, if you think about it, the difference between deep fat fryer oil and room temperature, it's that same kind of difference, but the other direction in terms of coldness. So it is something that does need to be handled with some amount of respect. But with good respect shown, you can have some good fun with it, too.
A physics class in college, I did a superconducting lab with trying to remember the name of it. It's yttrium something. I can't remember the chemical. But they buy a whole DWAR every trimester. They buy 3 a year, and they only have 2 classes. So we had fun the rest of the term.
Yep.
So I mean, it was a blast. We take it and throw it at the on one of the lab counters in this big cloud of steam. There, it was just fun.
Yeah, you could do stuff like freeze stuff in it, and stuff will freeze. Stuff. You can take like a rose. You can just freeze the rose, and then you can just shatter the whole thing. You can drop beets into it and freeze a beet, and then take a hammer. It was actually Alexis and Aki, who have a website, Ideas and Food, fantastic website. they've done stuff where you take a beet, you drop it in liquid nitrogen, and then you hit it with a hammer, and you get these really intricate, beautiful shards of beet you can then cook with. There's some fun stuff you can do there.
We'll have to pass that on to our Australian friends who love beetroot. There you go. Nice, Joel. So, Jeff, what is your favorite food to cook?
Oh. I don't think I've been asked that one yet. You know, I'm probably in some ways a simpleton, I guess. I would say a really good piece of fresh produce, like a really, really beautiful peach or strawberries. Like, don't even cook it. Just like, you know, there are times when if you get a really good product and you don't have to do anything to it, those are some of the best things. Now, I don't know if you call that cooking or not, but in terms of thinking about like a single thing to work with in the kitchen, where you just have a really great product to work with, and like it just has so much flavor. I mean, it's like if you're working with video or working with audio stuff, or if you're looking at a performance, anytime somebody gives you a really great performance and you don't have to do anything, or actually, here, take photographs. If you take a photograph and like the exposure is just perfect and you don't have to do anything to correct it, like it's just a beautiful image. Whereas if you've got a photograph which is overexposed or underexposed, you can correct it, but never is quite as good as a thing that's just perfectly exposed. And I think the same thing's true in food. If you get something where the flavors are just right, you know, it's perfect. And if you get something that's like, you know, not quite ripe enough or overripe, like you can try dicking around with it, but you're never going to be able to quite get it back to where it was. And maybe you take that peach that's a little bit overripe, and maybe you slice it up and you turn it into a really nice peach tart. But it really depends upon the ingredient. So I don't think for me it's like I look at it and think, oh, well, my favorite ingredient is steak or something. Because that's really not the case for me. It just depends upon what it is I'm working with. I don't know. It's kind of not the answer you were expecting, but that's what comes to mind.
Works for me. What about cooking style, cuisine style? Do you have any preferences there?
Oh, it's probably going to run along the lines of something Mediterranean. I generally prefer stuff that's, you know, a handful of really clean ingredients, nothing too complicated. Depends on time of year. A really good cassoulet or a really nice French onion soup in the dead of winter is beautiful, but do not serve it to me in July, unless I'm in the Southern Hemisphere, in which case do not serve it to me in February. So it really depends on the time of the year. But I'd say during the summer, I tend to go for very light, clean flavors, just nice grilled fish, some asparagus, maybe a slice of lemon. And in the winter, maybe something that's a little more hearty. But again, I kind of think the best meals are things that have like maybe 5 ingredients in them. Nothing too complicated.
I do have one question, since it is November and it is coming up. What's your Thanksgiving going to look like this year? Are you cooking?
I am not cooking. I'm going to a friend's place, which I'm looking forward to. As much as I enjoy looking at how things work in the kitchen, and as much as I enjoy going into the kitchen, I don't particularly enjoy spending hours and hours and hours in the kitchen. I'm the kind of guy that actually likes to go in and maybe spend half an hour putting something together. And maybe if it's a special occasion coming up, I'll spend a little more time, maybe do some pre-planning. But I'm not somebody that really wants to spend all day in the kitchen. And Thanksgiving to me is one of these holidays which is just, people have high expectations for the food. You know, oftentimes there's family members involved that don't normally come together, so you get conflict. I guess for me, the best Thanksgivings I have been to have actually been ones that are potlucks, where everybody kind of brings one dish and you all come together, and it's about the community and about sharing stuff together.
Great.
And everybody bringing something. So, you know, I remember a couple years ago, friends of mine got a turducken. This is a turkey with a duck with a chicken, I guess, all kind of smashed together. And so they got that, and different people brought different sides. And I decided I would make and bring what I called a pumpkin-ready yam. It was a pumpkin with another kind of squash inside with a yam in the middle, just all nested together. And it actually turned out great. But it's one of these things where, you know, that's fun to go and do. But if I had to do an entire Thanksgiving dinner, all of it, you're talking about a lot of work and a lot of, you know, high expectations. Yes. So really, I think potlucks and Thanksgiving should actually be done more often because it's a great way to do it.
It is. Is this Thanksgiving gonna be a potluck for you, or is it just you're going and eating?
I don't know yet. I'll probably get asked to bring something, and I will happily oblige.
I do like that squash idea. That's really interesting.
It's fun.
You know, to me. Oh yeah, and sweet potatoes and pumpkin itself, they kind of are very similar in taste and somewhat in texture a little bit. Pumpkin's a little bit different, but
what I did was I took the pumpkin, I cut it in half, I smeared it with olive oil and some salt, and let that roast. I took I think it was a spaghetti squash, and I did the same thing with that. I just picked three things that would fit inside of each other kind of successfully. Like your little Russian dolls, you know, baked that independently, and then did the same thing with the yam. And then I pulled it all out, and I assembled it, and I put spices in between each layer. So I think one layer had oregano, like fresh oregano leaves. So just take the pumpkin, throw some oregano leaves inside there, kind of, you know, make sure it gets distributed around, and then put the half of the spaghetti squash cut inside of that. You know, you still have a whole squash. So you just take the squash, cut it in half. That's how you roasted it. Put that inside, and then did the same thing with the yam, and some more spices and seasoning inside there, maybe some walnuts and maple syrup and, I don't know, cayenne pepper for the fun of it, or whatever strikes your mood.
That sounds pretty good, actually.
It was delicious.
I love it. No, I know. I love that stuff, and like, some of my best recipes has been, like, my office used to be over the culinary school where I work at Columbus State Community College. And the lady downstairs, she ran a whole bunch of restaurants, and she doesn't work there no more, but they used to do this thing on in-service day where she'd have a session and she'd show you how to cook something. And one year she did a sweet potato, sweet potato cheesecake that had streusel on top. And let me tell you, that was delicious, and I've made it a couple times and switched the sweet potato out for pumpkin. Worked perfectly with either ingredient.
Huh.
I mean, it was just, it was great. I wish I had the recipe. I can't find it no more.
We'll try to back it out. Try to make it from memory and see how close you can get. And then once you have something kind of approximate, send it to me so I can give it a try.
Yeah. Yeah. I just might have to do that because it was fantastic. I always... That's one of my things I like to do. Cheesecakes is one of my desserts I like to make. Another one I like to make is cinnamon rolls. For me, cinnamon rolls, rolling them out, some working with the dough, that's very satisfying and it's like a big stress reliever for me, working with the dough.
I hear you.
The only downside is it puts on weight on the tummy after you eat.
Right.
Yeah.
I've got a question.
Okay.
Why this may be my perception, why is day-old spaghetti or leftover pizza better? Is there something going on with the tomato, with the acid? I mean, it's always better to me.
Yeah. Well, in the case of stuff like lasagna and pizza... Well, let's back up and let's think. What are the possible chemical reactions that can be occurring? Stuff like lasagna. Okay, there's two different things here. I'm trying to figure out how to lay it out in a nice, uniform, brilliant answer. But I mean, I just have to give it to you two ways. The acid level in tomato technically does change a little bit when you cook it, but not that much. It's generally kind of around the 4 to 4.5 pH level. It doesn't really shift dramatically. It really has to do with the flavors and the volatile molecules that are present in the ingredients essentially breaking down over time and really getting a chance to meld together. This is actually the same exact reason why Chinese food does generally not taste so much so good the next day, because stuff like Chinese cuisine really relies on the distinct flavors still being distinct and having a fair amount of pop to them. And once they kind of meld and blend together, it's just not quite as good. But something like lasagna or your pasta sauces, that's actually not the case. Where they do get a chance to stew together and kind of break down, you get a more melded flavor. The other thing that can go on with these sorts of things, things that are high in collagen, meats, when you cook them, the collagen breaks down, denatures, hydrolyzes, turns to essentially, well, the precursor of gelatin. I mean, it is gelatin. That's where Jell-O comes from. But that gelatin has to be given a chance to set if you actually want to have that sort of, you know, lubricious set feeling to it. So there are some dishes where you do need to actually let them cool down specifically so that gelatin gets a chance to actually do its thing and stabilize it. This is exactly the same reason why things like lemon meringue pie need to actually cool down. It's so that the starches in the case of the lemon meringue pie can actually cross-link and form into a gel network. So
that's an emulsion, isn't it? The meringue, is that not egg whites and air?
No, not in the custard filling of a lemon meringue pie.
Okay, in the custard, okay.
There you actually, it's the cornstarch. I mean, the meringue itself is just egg white, where you're just whipping up the egg white. So it's technically, I guess you could consider it a foam. You know, it's a blend of air plus liquid, unless you dry it out like a meringue cookie, in which case it's a brittle foam, you know, air plus solid. You know, that wouldn't be an emulsion in that case. There it's actually just quite literally the actual, you know, in the case of the cornstarch that you might put into the meringue custard, they need a chance to actually entangle across each other and to kind of create a three-dimensional mesh that will trap, you know, the surrounding liquid into, well, a gel. I mean, it's not actually an emulsion in the traditional sense.
Well, that's wild about the what you said about the gel. And I formulate soft gel vitamins, and we work with very large quantities of both bovine and porcine gelatin. I mean, 350 kgs at a time, and cross-linking and denaturing and hydrolysis, all that stuff is something I see every day, but I never thought about it possibly making my spaghetti taste better the next day.
Well, it's certainly involved in some things in your kitchen. I don't know if so much as spaghetti, unless you're talking about, you know, a bolognese sauce that's got a lot of meat in it. In which case, maybe you do see it there. I would think you would see it a little bit in lasagna. But I think really the most important thing that's happening there with the day over leftovers taking better is quite simply a lot of the herbs and spices that have a lot of aromatic compounds are just getting a chance to actually break down and meld and kind of blend in a way where those flavors are able to come out just differently.
Now, see, Dave, if you just cook it at a low temperature for a long
time... I don't cook anything, Dan.
Like, at the next day, then when you go eat it the next day...
My favorite dish, if I had to pick my last meal, I knew it was going to be tomorrow, I would go to this Greek restaurant down the road and get chicken fingers and French fries and put gravy on all of it. And I wouldn't cook it. I'm not a healthy eater.
I don't think anybody is here, but...
Now, that's making an assumption, Joel. Sometimes we eat poorly. But I'd like to think most of us would...
Generally, I don't.
...choose better food. Better quality food.
Yeah.
Like a box of Kraft macaroni and cheese, but not the Kraft macaroni and cheese. The generic kind for 10 cents.
Kraft macaroni and cheese sucks. Bad.
Shame
but
on
it's
you.
College
How
food.
You?
It's college food.
Next you're going to be telling us that ramen, top ramen sucks too, huh?
Worst ramen in the store does suck. If you had good ramen, then you know what I'm talking about.
There's no comparison there, but sometimes you just got to hack out that hunk of fried noodle, throw it in a pot,
yep.
Then serve it to the kids and go out and get yourself something.
That's right.
When you were growing up, Jeff, did you have parents that were really into cooking, and were they good cooks?
Yeah, actually, I consider myself really lucky to have had parents that actually did take time. So not only cook, but also kind of cook with me growing up. I remember my dad showing me, like, in first or second grade how to make pancakes. And it was just something that was part of my background. Actually, when I got to college, I discovered this was not typical. I was surprised at how many of my classmates did not know how to cook.
Here.
I love my mom, but she was just not a good cook. Not at all. No, I mean, she's wonderful in other ways, but just not... Which I'm surprised that I managed to come out of this really enjoying to cook and trying out new things, playing around with food.
So your dad was the cook?
Yeah, actually, my parents are divorced, so it turns out that both my stepdad and my dad do most of the cooking, but my mom also did a fair amount of cooking early on. My stepmom does not cook at all. Although I'm sure she could, she just doesn't.
Yeah. I was actually asking Dan that, but that's cool too.
Yeah, I wonder if you seen your dad and stepdad, I assume they were cooking in front of you when you were a child, both of these men.
Yep.
I wonder if that had anything to do with, I mean, traditionally, and this just sounds like topping and theory, but probably safe to say most women do the cooking. I mean, I grew up watching my dad do the laundry, so I laundry, but I don't do any cooking. But I know when I switched majors to food science, this was in the 80s, it was traditionally considered like a female major. I was actually made fun of a little bit because, you know, there were a lot of girls there, which was good for me, but, well, it, potentially, but it didn't work out that way. But, as a study, it's heavily, I guess, populated with females. I don't know if I have a point.
well, genders and job and roles and stuff, sure. I mean, I think what's happened is in the last 5 or 10 years, for a certain class of American citizen, cooking has become a luxury activity. Because if you look at somebody who actually has a full-time job, in the software world at least, and they're going into their kitchen and cooking, they're not doing it necessarily to save money. Because for these people, they could essentially go out and buy food, and they'd probably have it be cheaper in terms of labor and cost, right? So I think a lot of it at this point really comes down to, well, luxury activity. And so for these people, you know, it's not so much about gender roles as it is about kind of, you know, pastime and enjoyment and leisure activity, which is just very different.
Now, Dave, as a food scientist, what, I mean, the way that I look, when you talk about food scientists, I picture chemistry, biology, and all sorts of classes. And the way you just presented it in, like, a 1956 viewpoint of gender role.
It's 1984, Dan, in the South. Go ahead.
You made it sound more like home economics than food science.
That was the perception at Clemson with people that weren't, you know, Clemson was an agriculture college, and the food science program was part of college agriculture. And Clemson had Clemson and Michigan State and NC State had one of the first food science departments, maybe. So it wasn't a new department, but the perception amongst my peers, I guess, when I changed majors to that was, why are you in a girl major? And I don't know if it was ignorance. I'm not saying I felt that way. The reason I changed is because I didn't want to be a microbiologist. I mean, I didn't know what I wanted to major in. If I had a time machine, I'd be, you know, a computer scientist. But it was this perception, I think, of people that didn't know what food science was. I mean, it wasn't home ed or anything like that. I mean, and, you know, and what I do is mainly commercial stuff. I mean, for companies, it's not anything. I don't cook. Maybe because I it's what I do for a living, sort of. But.
You don't have to defend yourself, Dave Yates. Joel, to answer your question, no. My dad cooked on a rare occasion, and he really did a good job cooking when he did. I mean, his food was really, really good. And he liked to cook more traditional Slovak kind of recipes that he grew up eating up in Wilkes-Barre. But he worked so many different swing shifts. He left the cooking to my mom, and we got... Some things we got were good. Like, my mom made a nice, a pretty good spaghetti sauce. Some things were terrible, like this baked pork chop and lima beans was...
Ugh.
Yeah.
It don't even sound good.
Believe me, it wasn't good. It was awful. And that's all, like, everything else was just destroyed by the baked pork chops and lima beans. My mom made a pasta primavera sauce one time, and she made it low fat, and it was clear. I don't know how she did it, but it was clear. A clear
pasta primavera that was clear.
Yeah.
Wow.
So,
yeah. Do you have a favorite thing?
What?
I'm asking Jeff if he has a favorite thing.
A favorite thing?
Thing. I'm from the South, so it sounds different. But being from Boston, I get Boston beans. But...
Favorite bean.
Favorite bean.
Oh.
Yeah.
Cannoli beans. There. We'll go with that. I don't know.
What do you expect you to say, like mung bean or something?
Ugh. I don't know. I mean, I had a new green bean the other day. I'd never had before, and I thought it was great.
A what green bean?
It was. I guess I'd had it before, but never cooked at home. It was it was actually grown. My mother-in-law grew it. It's like a 36-inch long, Thailand green bean. It was great.
36 inches long.
They grew up to 36. I think it's something like 28. But yeah, it was a very long green bean, but it was delicious. It was stir fried.
One bean feeds
a
family of four.
How do you stir fry that? Did you cut it up?
Yeah, you cut it up.
I hope so.
That was a really good bean, then.
Now, Dave, personally, I always find myself going back to just a simple black bean. I really love black beans.
Oh, me too.
Black beans are good.
So many things. So many things you can do with them too.
And I like them. I like the dried bean that you have, you know, soak in the water overnight and everything. More than I like it in the can.
Yeah. Soak them in beef stock with a couple cloves of garlic and some cumin. There you go.
Mmm.
And do whatever you want with
them. That sounds yummy.
Now, if I'm not mistaken, you're not supposed to soak them in salted water, right? Or is that not cook them in salted water?
I want to say it's not.
Or am I off base on that?
I think you can cook them in salted water. I don't think you want to soak them in salted water.
Right.
Because it'll make them too tough. Am I right on that, Jeff?
I offhand don't know, but I would answer this by going to Google and Googling.
That's what we.
Right, I'm looking here. I'm looking here. Dried beans.
Now I have to say that, like I said, With you with Thanksgiving, and I agree, that's the way I like to do our Thanksgiving. But last year, I did it all. And it was a lot of work. But I really enjoyed it. It really didn't bother me any.
I have a good time doing that kind of stuff, too. I would sometimes do, like Christmas Day. You know, my wife works every other Christmas, you know, because she works at a hospital,
right.
So... You know, I would prepare. You know, I'd actually make a couple days out of it. I'd have everything like chopped and prepared the day before that. You know, so the next day I can assemble everything. I usually smoke a turkey, so I'll smoke a turkey, and that can just kind of sit on the grill and do what it needs to do. You know, I mean, it'll. I kind of, you know, plan it out accordingly. You know, so that I'm not just rushing around like crazy on that day.
Yep. But then I did try Alton Brown's turkey recipe one year. That was awesome.
Which one? He has a couple.
The brining one with the... It's the one where they hit, like, you put the apple in it, in the neck.
Yeah.
I can't remember.
Yeah.
He did it on Good Eats. It's one of the ones.
Mm-hmm.
The older one, I think it was. But...
Jeff, have you reached out to somebody like him? Because he seemed kind of like right on the same, you know, page together.
Oh, yeah.
I know he's more of like a you know, more of a personality. I've actually met him, and you know, and he's not a chef per se, and he's not a, you know, he's not trained per se, but you know, he just kind of, you know, kind of like what you're doing, you know, went out and learned a lot of the stuff on his own.
Yeah, he'd be a lot of fun to talk with.
Savage too.
Well, I did talk with.
I know you did. That's why I'm saying I try to get him on here because I think it would be a really interesting show. Plus, I hear he actually uses Linux, so which would kind of fit in. But
hey,
but, I mean, I just
I run CentOS, so
yeah,
right there with you.
Yep. I mean, it just seems, to me, it seems natural. I mean, to be, if you're at all into computer science at all, you know, it's so much alike to me. Cooking and computer science, there's so many different parallels. You know, setting up your variables, i.e. chopping your vegetables, you know. All that kind of stuff, you know.
Jeff, the people that you did interview in the book and did, you know, got tips from, were those just, you know, brief sit-down interviewing for the book, or did you have, you know, be able to carry on some kind of other relationship other than that, you know, communicating with these people over a period of time?
For the most part, they were just telephone interviews. It turns out to be much easier to do those sorts of interviews not in person, actually, because you can take notes and, you know, look stuff up on the computer and, you know, be mindful of kind of where the conversation needs to get a good interview. Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
Thanks.
See, I'm looking here at some stuff that says maybe you don't really need to cook or soak beans so much. It's so many different ideas.
You can cook them for about 10 minutes or so, and on high, let them boil for about 10 minutes, and
yeah,
they're somewhat ready to use. And then, or you can go the other route, which I think is the more traditional route, is let them soak overnight.
Yeah, cold
soak.
Play around
yeah.
more with that.
You cook them till they fall apart.
There you go, Dave.
To me, that's cooking too much, though.
Then you throw them out
beans.
In the backyard, you open the can, right?
Right. Jeff, have you ever heard of anybody cooking, like beans, pinto beans, in a slow cooker with a potato inside to degas the beans? Have you ever heard that?
That sounds like old wives' tale to me.
Yeah, that sounds like old wives' tale to me, too. And slow cooking beans is actually kind of a dangerous thing. You actually want to actually boil them. Was one of the compounds that generates gas, an intestinal distress or whatever euphemism you want, is actually needed up to a hotter temperature than what a slow cooker would traditionally get to. So if you cook
right.
beans in a slow cooker, you need to actually boil them first.
Okay.
And,
right.
and just the rule of thumb with that, Dave, is to eat smaller bites and chew the hell out of them, and then you'll be less likely to have any reaction yourself afterwards.
The reason right. I bring it up is because a friend of mine, wives-tale or not, I think his mom cooked a potato in the beans for that purpose. And this friend of mine ate the potato and suffered greatly. I don't know if it was imagined or what, but he suffered greatly.
Well, still, there's always going to be that, you know, reaction inside you, you know, when you have beans. So, no matter what, whether he's eating the potato or the beans, you know, when the potato was soaked with the beans or cooked with the beans, you know,
flatulent beans.
Yeah, that starch and whatnot is gonna, you know, eventually, you know, get out of there and probably permeate that potato. So
now, Mike,
go ahead.
I'm sorry, my grandmother. she always put mustard seed in her sauerkraut to prevent the gas. That's what she said. I don't know. It actually tasted like good anyway.
It sounds like she just liked the taste of mustard seed.
That's the only thing I can think of.
So, Jeff, do you use CentOS?
I do on my servers, yes.
On your server? What do you use on the desktop?
I use a Mac, so OS X.
Is that your personal servers, or is that work-related servers?
Sort of both. Yeah.
Ah.
In other words, it's my choice to run CentOS.
Now, why do you run CentOS as opposed to just RHEL? Cost?
Yeah, partly. I mean, it's one of these things that just kind of happened.
Uh-huh. I gotta say, CentOS is really nice. We use that at work, and I also have a system with Cent that runs the virtual stuff, virtual machines here. But, CentOS is really nice. How long have you been running Linux?
1998, maybe? So, 12 years?
That's some good stuff. Good stuff. Now, do you have an iPhone then, too?
I do. Yeah. Sorry, guys.
Wait. Do you have an iPod also?
I don't. I think my Apple products are just iPhone and my laptop.
Ooh.
What about Android, man?
What type of work do you do, though, Jeff?
Oh, let's leave that out of this conversation.
Okay.
I'm just here to talk to food.
All right.
Food.
Any other food questions at this point?
No, we're pretty much... Do you have any tips that you'd like to pass on to our audience before we start wrapping this up?
Yeah, I would say kind of hindsight.
Go ahead, Jeff, I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. I would say, in general, if you're afraid of going into the kitchen and cooking, just get in there and try it. I mean, I think the biggest issue for so many people is just, I don't know where to start, and really the place to start is just kind of wherever you want. Pick up something that you think is going to be relatively easy, and go and try doing it. And don't be afraid about burning the dinner. It happens. You learn. You know, I really wish people would find it, you know, not be afraid of it. It can really be a lot of fun.
I agree.
You know what? I have a question. What is the worst thing that you've ever made?
Whoa. Well, I once took some, I think it's probably agar, and made some Earl Grey tea that was solidified. It was just like, hey, I wonder if I can solidify Earl Grey tea, and yes, you can, and it's so not delicious and so not interesting.
Did you actually serve that to people then?
Did you actually serve that to people, or is that just for you?
No, I was just testing stuff for the book.
That's pretty wild.
Definitely
doesn't sound appetizing.
I was going to say exactly what he was going to say. I was going to say the tip could be on how to get started cooking, and Jeff just nailed it. I mean, that's my opinion, too, with this. I mean, don't be afraid. Pick up a recipe. Read the recipe before you do it, and then just have at it. You'll learn.
Yep. I agree.
It's nothing like learning through mistakes.
Sometimes mistakes are delicious.
Yeah. Sometimes they're not.
That's true.
Just remember, pork chops and lima beans. Not a good thing. Jeff, I want to thank you for coming on the show tonight. The book, Cooking with Geeks, is fantastic.
Thanks so much.
Just
my pleasure.
Wonderful.
I so agree.
We really appreciate you coming on, and hopefully we can touch base with you again sometime in the future.
I look forward to it.
And if you have any questions for us, fire away, or we can just wrap things up here and call it a night.
Sounds fantastic. Thanks so much for having
all
me.
Right. Well, thank you, and have a happy Thanksgiving.
You too.
You too. Keep talking
right.
to you, Jeff.
See you, Jeff.
Thanks, Jeff.
Hey. Good night. Take care, and happy Thanksgiving.
Good night. Have a good night.
Happy Thanksgiving to you.
All right, Joe, John, Dave, Chad.
John Boy.
Anything else before we close up the show?
Do we want to do the contest this week, like Link was saying, or should we just skip
Let's wait for Link, because I don't even know what the contest is.
Yeah, I know. He just sent it out today. But I do want to say something, and yeah, he did.
Oh, yeah. Don't, I think I know what you want to do. Go ahead.
But, if, I don't know if any of you guys know Amber and Pete Grainer.
Yep. Amber's working on the Southeast Fest with us.
Well, they just, their house got struck by lightning, and it went up in flames. And Ricky Kite, yeah, she has set up a fund, and I gotta find the link here. And once I find it, I'll post that in the IRC.
The Grainer family chip in.
Did you? Yeah. There you go. Thanks.
I posted it.
Yeah. So, but basically, I'm sure they probably insured and all that. But as you know, insurance probably isn't going to cover it all. And amazingly enough, when I looked, it was up to $5,000, which I thought was awesome.
Roll back off the mic a little bit, you're tackling.
Sorry. But that, I just think, you know, it'd be nice if you guys could check that out. And if you can afford to chip in a few bucks, it'd be greatly appreciated by them. And they've done so much for the Linux community.
Yes. And no one was hurt.
Yes. That's important. No one's hurt. Everybody made it through. But as you know, think about your own house going up, how much you would lose. You know, you lose everything, your family history, everything. So, please think about them, and I want to thank Ricky Kite for setting that up, and she is also she's the publisher for Ubuntu Magazine, and what's the other one?
Linux Pro,
yeah. And they've given us some magazines, and I think since we just found out about it today, it's probably going to be a, I don't know, I think we might want to toss around the idea for the questions.
Well, how about we say this?
Yes.
There's probably going to be trivia questions.
Yes.
It's going to be one on the website, one on the forum, one on the mailing list, and one on the show. So keep an eye on those areas, mailing lists. If you don't want to sign up, you can always look at the archives. They are publicly accessible. So just be aware of that. Sometime between now and the next show, we'll be announcing some trivia questions. And it could be the next show, or it could
right.
be tomorrow. But it's probably not going to be tonight.
Right. Considering we're already over. So
here's a question. What did Dave Yates suggest putting in a pot of beans to reduce the gas?
Oh, that's too recent, man. The same show, even.
You know what you do, Dave? You take the potato out, you eat the beans, and you stick the potato up your ass. Then you don't have to worry about gassing people out.
You should eat the potato. I really think you should. You should try this. Sacrifice your body for science.
What you did before you went to OLF, Dave?
No.
Cooked up some beans and a potato in the microwave?
No. I'm not doing that.
Do you poke holes in your beans to let the gas out?
No.
Play us out, man.
I'm going to play us out. I just want to make a mention of the fact that Hacker Public Radio still looking for people to do shows and, you know, always looking for content. So head on over to hackerpublicradio.org and hit the promo area there. Check it out. And if that's it, gentlemen, I will play us out as I did not promise anybody. I figured I'd play the latest release from Fat Chance Lester. The Zombies Don't Feel Pain on their Halloween release.
Also, they don't feel brains, but they eat brains.
That's it. So enjoy Fat Chance Lester. That is our buddy Not Klaatu has done the post-production on them or producing for them. And we'll see you next week. Do we have a guest next week? Italo Vignoli, the Document Foundation is a possibility. So we shall see. All right, don't all answer at once.
Yeah.
Here it is. Zombies Don't Feel Pain.
Thanks for listening, everybody.
Thanks.
And for some reason, I don't hear this audio on here either. What the heck?
Oh, you look there.
Nah, it's
nothing I kill.
Hello world, this is Flick Zero, and I wanted to talk to you a little bit about Hacker Public Radio. You've listened to it enough, I'm sure, you love the shows, but what makes it different from other podcasts? It's produced by the community. That's right, people just like you. There's no restrictions on how long the show could be, nor on the topic it could cover, as long as they are of interest to hackers. It's so easy to contribute to. Just go to hackerpublicradio.org and click on Contribute. All the information you need is right there.
What I want from you, I want you to be the same. That is what you will do. You will spoon-feed the news, the same technology news, to everyone. You will not help people. You will not give them tips. You are not unique. You will conform. No, we won't. Join the revolution in Augcast. Listen to the GNU World Order. For more info, go to www.thebadapples.info.
Can we talk about the new search of computers?
Can we talk about multiprocessing?
Can we talk about Beowulf busters?
Can we talk about Web 2.0?
Just stop geek for me.
Just talk geek for me.
Hey, it's Peepy. Please come check out my podcast for my take on all things geeky. You can find us at www.talkgeektome.us. That's www.talkgeektome.us. Thank you.
Just talk geek to me.
So we can paint anything we want?
Anything at all.
How about if I paint your fine ass? Yeah, with my tongue brush. Shut up. Just shut up.
Daddy has a gun!
It's over.
It's over. And this is for Claudio. And Ken.
Would you like to know?
Ken.
Do it.
Do it. Yeah.
Would you like to know?
Do it.
No.
Bitch, you like
they heat up?
What did Dave eat?
They heat. I'm still here.
Do you like hot food?
You like hot food.
Spicy food.
Yeah.
Alright, so that's
good. Shut that crap off.
What are you talking about? That is not crap, sir. We should play that as the background music for an entire show.
Yeah, that would be cool.
Everyone's probably going, no!
We missed Halloween, so we could have did it for that.
Yeah, we should have. That would have been perfect.
I'm telling you, Dan, you and Pat got to do a Java episode. The future of Java.
Do.
What were you going to say, girls? What?
Oracle.
It's open, JDK.
Yeah. I was going to say, how... Yeah. I was going to say, Dan, how was the girls' Halloween, man? They looked cute.
Oh, yeah, they had a lot of fun. They were real into it this year about getting dressed up and going out. Last year, we made it a block, like, just to the end of our block, and that was it. And they didn't want anything else to do with it. And this year, they were like, no, let's go more. It was cold out, and...
I'm gonna
but
say
they had a good job.
If your church has a trunk or treat, take them. Oh my God, we had our first one this year,
that's a
and
what?
It was fantastic. Trunk or treat. Trunk or treat.
What does trunk or treat mean?
Okay, what you do is you decorate your trunk on your car, and you pop it open and in a parking lot. And the kids just go from car to car getting candy. Trick-or-treating. It's awesome. You get so much candy in one shot, it's not funny.
We don't really give them a whole lot of candy, so... I've never heard of that way around here, but I don't need it in the house here.
Right. It's something a lot of churches do as an alternative to the regular traditional trick-or-treat. So...
I have never heard of that. Actually, you know what? I recently did hear something similar to that, but they do that instead of, you know, in more rural areas where the houses are much more spread out, they would just go to, like, a field and do something like that instead of people drive from house to house, you know.
Mm-hmm. They do that down here.
There was at least three churches here that did it.
Now, see, Clive, you did a trunk or treat, but... The trick was that when you got close to his van, he yanked you in and drove up. You know, the first time I heard about it was on the one of the church marquees had it on it. I'm like, what is trunk or treat? I couldn't figure out what the trunk was. But when you say decorate your trunk, I pictured people pulling a trunk down from their attic and decorating that.
Yeah. No. But, like, some of the people that really got into it. Now, me, I just threw, a blanket down and had my bowl out, and I was standing there handing out treats to the kids. It was fun.
That was real fun. Scary enough right there.
Well, you did see my picture on Facebook, so.
Oh. Trunk or treat, baby.
Nothing really new this year for trick or treat. Although, he didn't get that many M&Ms.
You know what was kind of new for me this year, Trick or Treat? Was the fact that so many people came by without costumes this year.
Yeah,
with
I know.
Their hand out.
Maybe
they were going as...
Yeah.
I don't care who they were going as. You know what?
15-year-old kid. No costume. Trick or Treat!
Dude, at least have the courtesy to put, like, a bag over your head or something.
Right.
Where's the green thing? Oh, here it is.
That's what she said.
Yeah, put a bag over your head.
No, she said, where's the green thing?
Oh.
Hey,
curve.
Yeah. Are we doing a show Thanksgiving week?
Oh, I probably won't be here.
That's what I'm thinking. That's not too far away. We've got two more shows and then it's Thanksgiving.
Is that all?
Yeah.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah, the 25th. I need to start picking up stuff for that too. Punk.
I just picked up a fork and I'm ready.
is your like wife cooking Thanksgiving dinner?
That's if I have. I started when we asked Jeff if he had any advice. I started to say, you know, don't. If I had any advice for anybody, it would be marry somebody that likes to eat. Because my wife will cook. I mean, she cooks every day, and I don't have to do anything.
She's a good cook?
Yeah. I don't even have to say I'm hungry. It's just, I mean, there's something cooked every day because she likes to eat.
So basically, she's your cooking cron job.
Yeah. Exactly.
You don't even have to say, Sudo, make me a sandwich.
Nope, don't have to do it.
It just happens, so it's cron.
If I want something before or after the meal, I have to do that myself. She'll cook the meals. If I want a sandwich, I have to do that myself.
Does she fix your coffee?
I don't drink coffee. But she only buys me Diet Mountain. She only buys me Diet Mountain Dew when I'm on sale, so...
Why is that weird? I think coffee's disgusting.
I love coffee.
I love it.
Me too.
I bet you guys do.
Best part of waking up, right, Dan?
Yep.
Gotta have it.
I do. I have to have it every... I had a cup sitting here tonight as we were on.
Now you're gonna go make me make one, man.
Do it. Do it. I dare you. Do it. Go ahead.
I got some good stuff. I got some good stuff from my Keurig. I'm the only one who drinks it, so I bought a Keurig.
I'm not sold on that machine. It doesn't make real good coffee.
It's okay. It's better if you use the K-cups.
Well, no kidding, but I do.
Yeah.
It just doesn't quite have the flavor that I'm looking for.
I like doing a French roast every once in a while. In the press pot.
Yeah. You mean a French press?
Yeah, French press. Yeah, that's what I meant. Yeah. Okay. I have one. I love it. That's the only way. That and pour overs would be the only other way I'd probably do it nowadays. It's a waste for me to make a whole pot because I'll have like two cups and that's it. And then at work I'll usually have two cups. I usually don't have anything until I go to work. Yeah, work coffee sucks, but it still keeps me awake.
I had to stop drinking what we have at work because it started irritating my stomach.
Well,
yeah.
What's the longest you've ever played a video game, Dan?
Uh-oh.
In one sitting.
I've killed my phone playing Angry Birds.
I would say at least 8 hours, but it probably was more like
12.
12 to 16.
Did you lose weight in the process? Did you think you gained 5 pounds playing that video game?
Did I what?
I don't know. Did you lose any weight while playing that game for those 8 hours?
No.
I bought Rock Band. I've got Rock Band 2, but I bought Rock Band 3 this past Saturday, and my wife and kids were out of town for the weekend. I played drums for 10 hours on Saturday.
Oh, God. Holy crap.
My wife doesn't know, but she was asking me why I was limping. I pulled a muscle.
Pulled a muscle.
I've got a blister.
That's awesome.
Dave pulled his blood muscle.
I've got a blister between my thumb and index finger the size of a cherry. It's brown now.
Your wife should be happy on that.
I didn't eat or anything. I think I had an 8 24-ounce Diet Mountain Dew. And that's the only time I got up was to go get something to drink. And I looked at the clock. It was 11 p.m. I started playing at 1. And I played the drums for 10 hours on Saturday. It was stupid.
It was great, wasn't it?
Oh, it was great, wasn't it? I bet I lost 4 or 5 pounds.
That's awesome. How many different songs did you play?
I don't know, Dan. I played just about everything. I played 10 hours.
10 hours. You got your money's worth out of that thing.
Oh well, we've had Rock Band 2 for a year, so I've been playing it for a while. I'm decent. I'm pretty good on the drums. But
PlayStation.
I bought the cymbal kit, so it was like new again. But it was cool.
I like playing guitar on that game.
But the new guitar has like 105 buttons. I mean, for like every finger position on the fretboard, which I don't think I'm interested in the drums. But
they have a keytar now.
Yeah. It's like $70. I've not gotten it.
That's pretty sweet, though.
What game did you play for 8 hours?
Well, let's see, what games have I played? I have played Zelda, the various Zeldas. I've had marathons of those. I have played Metroids for extended periods of time. It's been a while since I really put in, like, you know, more than...
Major.
2.5 hours at a clip.
Yeah.
Like, some... I've been kind of, like, hooked on some DS games lately that I've been playing for, like, 3 hours. 2-3 hours.
Now, did you play Angry Birds yet?
No, I don't...
Oh, Angry you should. Birds. It's free. Android.
Awesome I know game. It is. I saw so many postings about it. Everybody says it's the bee's knees. I'm still stuck playing Alchemy, man. I love that game.
it's
why
slow
you ask
game.
Dave Yates? What's the slow game? Alchemy or Angry
Alchemy,
Birds?
Alchemy.
Why
yeah.
you ask Dave Yates?
Alchemy.
I've not played either. I mean, I take that back. A guy at work had Angry Birds on an iPhone, and I think I saw it being played. But
pretty awesome.
But I'm not played.
I like it.
I did play Star Wars Force Unleashed 2 for 4 hours Sunday, but
how's that?
Right. It's better than the first one. It's not great. I mean, I'm halfway through, so I think when I'm finished, I probably won't play it again. But
that sounds like a short game.
Well, I say I'm halfway through. I'm probably halfway through. So.
Right.
Is that
Here's
on the PlayStation or the Wii?
It's PlayStation. I mean, it's for the Wii too, but I don't really buy anything for the Wii anymore just because of the standard death picture. But
that was fun though on the Wii, playing with the wand and stuff like
Wiimote.
That, the lightsaber and everything.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
Oh yeah.
Did you get that controller yet? The Move? I think the Move.
Yeah, I got the Move.
Yeah.
I heard it
sucked.
Pretty good. It's going to be better when they're better games. The Frisbee Golf is really fun, but that's about it right now.
Oh, man, we used to play that in college.
I think it'll be better.
Ultimate
My son just bowled another 300 a day on Wii Sports Bowling.
Really?
Yep.
That's great.
He's really great at the Wii Sports Bowling. He's getting better at bowling, too. Real bowling. He bowled a 146. No, with no bumpers.
Cool. I bowled a 277 once when I was in college.
277?
277.
That's the highest I think I had too, Dave.
Yeah, I think I averaged around 170 or 180.
That's like an open and mostly strikes? Probably.
Oh, I stopped recording. Say goodnight.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night, recording.
Testing. 1, 2.
Probably.
How did you know?
Oh, okay. So we were hearing the laundry going for a while there.
There was no laundry going. You were hearing a server fan.
Oh. It's hard to, you know, mix them up, you know.
I have that problem all the time. I find myself putting my laundry into my servers and they just don't come out quite clean enough.
If only you could do that.
But they sure are dry, right? All those fans going on.
Oh, good times. It's been a little while since I've been over to the colo where my servers are at, but yeah.
Who are we missing? Link?
Yeah, Link's not going to be on tonight.
Gorkon. We all know Chad's not going to be on.
Link's not going to be on tonight?
Yeah, you got to read your mail more often.
Oh, there we go. Well, Alan, I come right home from work and cook dinner, and then I can come over here and do the show.
All right.
Because I got screaming beasts that eat.
Yes, luckily I do not have to worry about that sort of thing.
All right.
Unfortunately, mine had a bit of a stomach bug tonight, so...
Uh-oh.
She had to get picked up from school early because she was not feeling well.
Did you have to pick her up?
No, I was in New York today, so my wife was home today, and she had to, luckily, could go down and get her.
Hey, y'all.
There he is, I'm waiting
for
Dave.
Hi, how you doing, Dan?
All right. Good,
how about yourself?
Good, I'm doing good.
Now we can start the show, right?
Yeah.
Good.
Heck yeah.
Give everybody that's important now.
How you doing, Alan?
Oh, not too bad. Not too bad.
How's the weather up there?
It's getting cooler.
It's raining here now.
Fall is upon.
Cooler, man. It was 23 degrees this morning when I was out.
Well, like I said, it's getting cooler.
I think we're supposed to get our first frost this weekend, so, I mean, we've been in the 40s. This will be 31, I think, Saturday or something like that. So, when that fact, if you don't
like the gas, you can get up your ass. All right, that's good level, right?
Yeah. Kind of good.
Are we waiting for Joel? Because I know he was all excited. To finally talk with Jeff. How you doing, Jeff?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Good, 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 good. We're all excited to have you on the show tonight.
Well, thank you. I'm excited to be here.
A lot of our listeners are excited, too. And when we're done, we're going to all be gourmands, right?
Absolutely. You're going to all know how to cook the perfect Thanksgiving meal. You'll have all of your food science questions answered, and life will be good.
Are you a food scientist, Jeff?
No, my background's actually computer science.
Okay, because that's what's funny is I'm a food scientist, and my hobby is computers.
Aha! So then we can trade all those deep insights into each other's professions, or at least backgrounds.
Well, I don't know. I'm not an enthusiastic food scientist. I hate my job, but...
What do you actually do?
I'm a bottling formulator. Before that, I worked in the salad dressing industry as a QC manager for a mayonnaise salad dressing manufacturer.
Got it.
So I've been doing vitamins since 95.
Okay. Salad dressing. So this is like what, keeping your dried spices in suspension inside the salad dressing? That kind of stuff? Or?
But emulsions, actually, mayonnaise and French dressing. Yeah, we were the contract manufacturer for Hidden Valley Ranch for the first 5 years of their existence.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
And mustard, just about peanut butter, Worcestershire sauce, a bunch of stuff. But like I said, I'm very unenthusiastic about all this. But I do think it's funny, though, that we're sort of like versions of each other turned inside out a little bit.
I suppose so.
The difference is, though, Jeff actually works with real food, Dave.
Chemical. Oh, we're running ourselves right into a deep, deep rabbit hole right away then. Because food is chemical, right?
Sure.
That pile of carrots, that, you know, corn on the cob, it's a bunch of starch, a bunch of carbohydrates, a bunch of sugars, a bunch of carbon.
Got more information on Dave's history and his career than in the last, 5 minutes than we have in 3 years?
But this is the only other person I've ever heard mention the words food science on the Wrestling Tech Show besides myself. And I only mention it because I'm an anomaly.
All right, so Jeff, you sound good.
Okay.
Dave, you sound good. Dan, you sound good.
Okay.
Alan?
I sound bad.
No, you sound good.
Okay.
Pat's not here. Pat quit?
Pat quit? I have no clue.
Oh.
No,
Alan, you
he's
got
he's got
I don't know.
he had to do.
I thought he's logged in.
Okay.
He's I don't know. I don't know where he is. All right, but we're going to get started. Because
he sent an email saying that he has a major rollout happening.
Pat does?
Yeah.
Yeah, we see him.
He said if it's a false quiet, it'll be on after 9 or 9:30.
A major rollout. Huh.
That's in the last email.
Okay. Well, we are going to start. And, Jeff, what we're going to do is play our show intro. It's about a minute. Then we will say our introductions, hellos, and introduce you and get right into it, okay?
Sounds great.
It's just freewheeling. Anything goes. No restrictions. But you will probably never hear from Alan again.
Yeah,
that's the way it goes.
Quiet while the interviews go on.
We do have an IRC channel, if you're at all interested in being part of that. I don't know if anybody gave you that information.
Not yet. I could pull up my IRC client, but honestly, it's easier to have these conversations where I'm not distracted by the back channel. So if you guys see something float by in there that you want to bring up, please bring it up.
That's no problem. Okay, everybody else ready?
Yep.
For me.
We're doing this one for Joel, since he's obviously not here.